The army doesn't like more than one disaster in a day.
Looks bad in the newspapers and upset civilians at their breakfast.
I'm Bill Buppert, retired army officer and a regular warfare practitioner and scholar. Welcome to Chasing Ghosts and a Regular Warfare podcast, the show that examines the mythos, lost history, bad thinking, martial malpractice, and government incompetence that informs so much of irregular warfare. I want to peek behind the curtain at the vast machinery and briar patch politics of insurgency and counterinsurgency and everything in between. Now, let's go ghost hunting together.
Hello, this is Bill, and welcome to Chasing Ghosts in a Regular Warfare podcast. This is episode 66, Civil War on the Horizon, The Empire Strikes Back. Some housekeeping is in order. I can take a breath and step back. The first half of the year has left. Academic conferences are complete. Professional conferences are complete. I just returned from the annual Military Operations Research Society Symposium. That was delightful as always. I am a working group chairman there for Working Group 32, Special Operations and Irregular Warfare. I also delivered some presentations myself, to include my customary annual anti-fragility tutorial that I give, talking about anti-fragility and future conflict in systems engineering. And also, I had two presentations. One was on the end of the aircraft carrier as the crossbow and chariot of the 21st century. And the other one was on the end of infantry, which I was sad to give that presentation. Feedback on both was positive. I was expecting a whole lot of pushback. But you know what? When you examine the forensic and technical details of both of those propositions, all of a sudden you know that you are staring square in the face at hundreds of years, if not millennia, of emerging contretemps to the way war was and the way revolutions and military affairs have changed everything. There is a bitter Russian saying, "The past is unpredictable." I love what the implication of that very phrase is. There's so much to tease out of it, but the history you have is the history that you interpret yourself, and much like science, there's no such thing as settled history. When new evidence emerges to press upon and question the very provenance, accuracy, and precision of received wisdom from the past. And as Mark Twain and Georges Santayana told us, it appears that history rhymes. It doesn't necessarily repeat itself, but the patterns look the same. I know that there's been hiccups of late in my ordinarily and very routine and ritualistic fortnightly issuance of podcast episodes. And now we will get back to it. I'm hoping between now and the Christmas or solstice holidays, whatever members of my audience may celebrate on those glorious days in December, when we can join with friends and families to give thanks for all the blessings that we have, for the place that we're at, no matter how modest your means or how expensive and lucrative your life has been. Count your blessings. As a matter of fact, I'm recording this on Father's Day, and I count my blessings because I have three strong sons, two strong daughters, seven grandchildren, and they are the legacy that makes me immortal, certainly not the podcast episodes or anything that I've done in my life, but hopefully the good things and the maybe few not-so-good things that I've done have equalized in a measure of success for all my children. So far, so good. When I first started Chasing Ghost 3 years ago, I knew that it would also be a steep learning curve for me and a learning experience over which, with time, maybe I will have arrived or claimed conclusions in past episodes that may not be quite right. I can't say that I'm there yet. I'm willing to examine superior evidence that correspondents or listeners to this podcast may transmit to me and let me know. What I have noticed, though, is that there's an aggregation and a comprehension effect in all of this. Comprehension, as Tom Clancy would employ the intelligence term, which means that his exposure to a variety of primary and secondary source documentation in books or maybe what he's consumed in media and such allows him to take on an almost prophetic means of extrapolating what warfare looked like in his novels and trying to make them very realistic and hewing to what either may have been contemporaneous at the time or dipping into the future in a very near-term perspective. So I'd like to review a few things and tie them with a bow before we continue on with this episode, and it is very germane to the subject of this episode, which is Civil War, which I do think is on the horizon, whether locally in this country, regionally in the area, or throughout the West, regardless of whatever hemisphere, northern or southern, you will find that the majority of civil wars and revolutions have occurred south in the southern hemisphere and within the Middle East since the end of World War II, which is a good demarcation line for us to employ to measure civil wars and such. Where we find ourselves at today is I am fond of saying, as I did last week during my presentations, that the American military complex, both logistically and its capability to render force abroad, is coming to a close, in my estimation. I absolutely think that with the advent of robotics, drones, FPVs, hypersonic munitions, and really the democratization of even third world and developing countries' capabilities, like Yemen, to really put a squeeze, if not a serious dent, in the once ubiquitous and strong armor of the U.S. and its Western coalition allies. I think, over the past weekend, we had the kerfuffle between Iran and Israel with the appropriate claims by both sides of how much damage was rendered and what happened. I'm going to use my 72 to 96 hour rule to say that I know nothing about that until all the dust settles, and then I'll make my own assessment via forensic analysis of what's going on around the world and what is revealed by the usual suspects and the narrative shaping machines in the coprophile media, as I refer to the mainstream media and what they're about. So I don't know if the U.S. Pentagon has gotten the memo, but having this extraordinary and prohibitively expensive 20th century fighting machine in all of its glory and bluster about firepower, as we know, for those of you who have been perennial listeners of this podcast, whether it's Chasing Ghosts or the companion podcast War Notes, which is a conflict podcast that I do to step outside of the irregular warfare portfolio and examine not only conventional conflict, but the lines and demarcations in which it meets hybrid and gray zone warfare. And then we also play around with a little conflict futurism over there. This means that power projection actual from U.S. forces or its NATO satraps, or its proxies, like what's happening in the Ukraine and elsewhere. I found it curious the other day when I was listening to a media report, there's a reason they call it programming, isn't there, where they were talking about the U.S. had withdrawn and redistributed air defense assets from Ukraine to elsewhere. And I thought to myself, isn't that a curious turn of phraseology to say that, as if they did not grant these weapon systems to the Ukrainians, but most likely, reading between the lines, not only were they loans, temporary, mind you, but I'll bet the staffing was also not exclusively Ukrainian, and all of a sudden we have them going to hotter hotspots around the world to secure yet another warmongering initiative elsewhere. But as I've reflected on in the past, the U.S. is increasingly finding that this exquisite platform-based, non-network-based joint operating concept abroad in what is arguably expeditionary warfare, because America must project its military power since it just so happens to have two vast oceans that protect it from a land invasion that is not seaborne, littoral, or amphibious. And no one on Earth has that capability. So the U.S. is always pimping for new wars and finding ways to get into new conflicts. I've talked about the maritime provocation history in past episodes. And now what we're going to find is that all of a sudden America is saddled with this very large military enterprise. And if history tells us anything, remember that Russian proverb, you may find that increasingly, whatever the administration, because remember in this podcast, we don't pay much attention to the uniparty with both of its left wings of Republicans and Democrats, because we know what they're about. What they're about is making war in the world. And if it just so happens, that can't be done. Making war at home with all of those exquisite tools and tactics and techniques and procedures that have been used abroad will be brought home. I spent almost 2 years in Afghanistan, and over there we used biometric means to establish who was who atomistically in the population, because they didn't issue driver's licenses per se, and it was very hard to have a functioning and accountable bureaucracy that could issue identification documents that could be held by human beings. Well, through biometrics, which meant that it was retinal scans, facial scans, and those kind of things, it was a way to individuate human beings in Iraq and Afghanistan who didn't happen to be American and be burdened, as we all are, with all the identification documents that we are required by our government, to whom we pay so much in taxes, who we are. Well, has anybody traveled through TSA recently and gone through the checks for getting on board the aircraft? You will note that there is an optical scanner that takes a picture of your face, most likely, and I don't know this, I'm taking a guess, a retinal scan of one type or another to individuate you as an atomistic human being on this tax plantation, so that they can make sure that your identification matches with what you profess it to be and let you get on board the aircraft as a result of that. That technology was perfected in Afghanistan and Iraq during the alleged global war on terror, which was the global war on evil, which is the global war on something we can't possibly have a victory in a war on evil, because evil never goes away. So what is a multi-trillion dollar government to do with all of these shiny toys and pretty assets and such, especially in a society that appears to be so politically rife with contesting parties of power and those who wish to impose their vision of how you live your life on you from above, most likely through central planning? All that is coming home, and all that will be here to roost, most likely, on our shoulders in a very unpleasant fashion. For those of you who have listened to my podcast from episode one, you know that I've talked about a concept called regional conflict complexes and the fact that larger wars tend to breathe oxygen onto the dormant and barely alive embers of previous conflicts that may be decades or even centuries old, maybe millennia old, as is what has happened with Islam since the 8th century and their conquest of the greater Middle East under the sword and other weapons during that time. What I had suggested was that these regional conflict complexes act as orchid houses, as greenhouses, as factory farms, as places in which these decades and centuries old wars, which have lain low for a period of time, all of a sudden do crop up once again. And all those troubles that appeared rather insoluble at the time start to experience compounding of troubles because of what's happened between the time that they went dormant and the time that they're emerging now. For instance, as I've said time and again, when it came to Afghanistan, Afghanistan in the Western mind was a country. Afghanistan in the Afghan mind outside of Kabul didn't exist, because the clans, the bloodlines, the inbred relationships, the centuries-old relationships between various villages and communities went on despite what the central government would do in Afghanistan itself. I suspect that here in the West, and I think the UK is somewhat not an outlier, but a bellwether as to what's going to happen in the future. I had the opportunity to listen to, and I will post the interview in the show notes. Andrew Gold runs this delightful podcast called Heretics. I am so envious of the fact that he's able to interview all these great guests in his fantastic studio, and I really admire the way he does his business. He had Dr. David Betts on there, and of course I will put this in the show notes. He is an irregular warfare historian and contemporary observer who has spent the last quarter century, according to him, in academia examining this very thing, and he has caused quite a bit of waves in the past year, where he has postulated, because of what is going on in the United Kingdom, that the possibility, nay, the probability of civil war there is increasingly evident in a way that tells him it is more so going to happen than not happen. Like all forecasting or prediction modalities, no one knows when these kind of things are going to kick off or if they are. You know, if someone could reliably tell you when a civil war would happen, you would think that there would be a whole lot of ways to make it go away, but that's not how politics and civilization render themselves, as we've seen from history. So I urge you to get a chance, if you get a chance to listen to it, I find some of his observations, with all due respect, rather pedestrian and at times milquetoast. But nonetheless, as a public intellectual in a place in which free speech is not held to high account whatsoever, and if one is left of center in British politics, by the way, that's all parties. Everything is like Israel. It is all left of left there. And various gradations. I don't blame him for hedging and maybe being hesitant to say things out loud, but I can read between the lines, and I see that with several things, demographics being destiny and illegal immigration and even encouraged legal immigration of folks who don't happen to be of like mind, religion, or political predisposition coming into England may cause a considerable amount of problems, especially when one can examine what has happened because of the wokeness, viral contagion in politics, and the happy medium that has given to encouraging organizations that are communist and socialist in their orientation to emerge from the fetid bottom of the pond, and that government supremacist poison starts to take on a life of its own, and of course, drive on to civil war. I think that when it comes to civil war on the European continent, which we will examine briefly, after 1945, one can certainly see evidence between 1945 and 1958, three distinct seismic shifts. That would be the shedding of European colonial powers. That would be the creation of the Eastern Bloc and the Warsaw Bloc, and the communist takeover of so many European countries. And then, by extension, those Eastern Bloc and Soviet forces, not to say that the U.S. and the West didn't do the same to Russian-dominated neocolonial holdings and ambitions, they most certainly did. But then you have the case where all of a sudden, after World War II, the Irish Republican Brotherhood, which evolved into the Irish Republican Army, would find itself after the war almost committed to a man and a committee to Marxism, Leninist Marxism, and Soviet succor and material support to what they were trying to do in Northern Ireland to unite them with the southern island of Ayr. You would also find the same thing with the Basque separatist group ETA playing footsies with both the Spanish and the French and running from one country to another for sanctuary while they conducted their terrorist campaigns and their civil war campaigns. Let's not forget that in 47 and 48, what the Islamists would refer to as the Nakba, which is the catastrophe, where Israel became a country in 1947 and 1948. I always like to remind people that the first country to recognize Israel as a state was the Soviet Union, because the kibbutz system and the socialist slash communist adjacent political reality of Israeli terrorist factions, whether it was Agana or Irgun, and then the merchant country there, would orient itself not only with the Russians for a period of time, lasting approximately 10 years into the 1950s, but would also find succor and support to create the ethno-state that they would become. A lot of people aren't aware that 92-93% of all the land in Israel proper is owned by the government and leased out to private landholders for a variety of reasons. Israel, arguably, geopolitically, has been involved in a civil war since its formation. Ireland the same until the Good Friday Accords in the late 1990s, even though there is a low hum to the conflict that has ironically emerged in the island of Ayr, which is Ireland proper, not Northern Ireland, which belongs to the United Kingdom in England, is that the Irish Republican Army, and I would say the lion's share of its splinter groups, have found that the marriage of Marxism and wokeness is one at which that altar has been sanctified for a very long time. So now they find themselves in that island called Ireland, below Northern Ireland, at odds with most people who reject the huge extent of illegal immigration that is changing the warp and woof of the culture down there. As a matter of fact, I would point out that my friend Matt Bracken has said that Ireland is on the precipice, is set for a civil war of one type or another. And if you're paying attention to the kind of violence that we're seeing there and the kind of paramilitary activities that are starting to emerge, it is something that we haven't seen in Ireland proper for decades, if not half a century. Civil war is contagious. This is what you found, for instance, if we confine ourselves to the 20th century, you find that to a certain extent, civil war was one of the predicates for World War I, but we also see that World War I, at its conclusion in November 1918, sets the train for decolonization between that time and the beginning of World War II. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that all the European nation states set down their arms and said, enough is enough, we're no longer going to occupy these countries, whether that is the French in Indochina, in Algeria, the British in India, who go on to lose the Raj after World War II in 1947 and 1948, which they had possessed as the Raj proper, and then Clive's British East India Company holdings from the 18th century until that time. And time and again, the European colonials find themselves in the hazard as far as keeping them. And of course, by the 1960s, a huge larder of these former European colonial holdings in Africa, in the Middle East, for instance, achieve independence of one type or another, and then go on, as I have mentioned before, about breathing oxygen into the embers of long dormant civil wars, other civil wars emerging. Much like Yemen is in the news right now, there are a number of factions in Yemen. There are approximately three factions there, two of which are major, that are at war with Saudi Arabia and the United States by extent. you will find that the Yemenis that give the West and the Saudis the most trouble just so happen to be in the terribly mountainous region of Western Yemen, which is a very curious area in which no Western force could succeed in wresting power from. It's much like when you look at Iran, and I've written and spoken on this, I would estimate, just being an amateur geography, roughly two-thirds of that country is very mountainous. And mountainous terrain is not optimal for invading forces to get a bridgehead, a lodgment, an expansion, and actually dominate and defeat those who just so happen to own that country at the time. I owe some of my inspiration to David Armitage, who wrote a book called Civil Wars, A History and Ideas, and I wanted to quote from it. Quote, "Civil war is an inheritance humanity may not be able to escape. By this, I do not mean that humans are inherently competitive, greedy, and aggressive, or that our lot will always be societal suicide, drive swords into our own entrails, as Lucan might have put it. Instead, I mean that civil war is one of those indispensable concepts that, once invented, has proved to be surprisingly translatable. It moved from Rome into many major world languages without difficulty and lost none of its accumulated awkward baggage. That innovation that had eluded the Greeks became, under the pithy oxymoron and compelling historical narrative devised by the Romans, an unassailable idea until the 19th century. Even the utopian promise of revolutionary change could not dethrone civil war from the repertoire of political thought, if only because politics itself was always a form of civil war by other, less deadly means. In this way, did the idea acquire the bewitching power of something not invented but discovered? So what can the historian do in the face of such a force? There are perhaps two ways to respond. One would be to try to recover some presumed essence of the term, to reduce somehow its profusion of meanings into something more manageable. The other would be to reconstruct it in all its complexity to uncover just how it became so fraught with significance. As we have seen in recent debates about conflicts in Iraq and Syria, attempts to confine civil war within a single definition have led only to further complication and contestation. It would seem better, then, to work from other direction and to excavate the various meanings of civil war as they have been laid down over the centuries. Abandoning the first approach, illusory promise of simplicity, one may yet be spared its inevitable result of perplexity." End of quote. I urge you, if you are interested in this, it is a great follow-on to the previous episode, maybe even a preamble to the previous episode that I did on color revolutions. Remember, I take a broader framework when it comes to the definitional veracity of the term civil war, the American Revolutionary War from 1775 to 1783. I refer to that certainly as a civil war because it fits within the parameters. When Paul Revere was astride his horse, given the warning that the Redcoats were out on that fated day, April 19th, 1775, he was British in the saddle at the time. So that certainly fits the definition of what one could find to be familial or brotherly strife, in this case, the secession and nullification of London's ability to run affairs on the Atlantic seaboard with who were then British citizens, who would then become American colonials, who would then establish their own country as a result of that. There are cold civil wars and hot civil wars. Cold civil wars, I think a great example of that would be the woke mind virus in American and by extension Western society that has been a modest and not hot civil war, but it has led to people losing their jobs, losing their incomes, going to jail, and any number of things as a result of not acceding, accepting, or affirming what those political constructs desired through force or a framing of force that didn't appear to be violent, but always had the hand of violence under the velvet glove. And then you have hot civil wars. And I think that the one where I must say this, the romance of civil war and the cinematic portrayal of it is rather bloodless, despite the blood on display on that 70mm screen watching the magnificent 1962 film Lawrence of Arabia. Yugoslavia. I would urge all of my listeners, if you want to get a sense of how visceral Western Civil War can get, you can certainly visit what happened in Yugoslavia in the 1990s and afterwards. You can certainly look at what has occurred with the ISIS incursions throughout the Middle East, to include Iraq and Syria. As a matter of fact, during the Syrian Civil War, which has been brewing for decades, we found that the Western client organization, Al-Qaeda, has finally found what it appears to be as a rightful and legitimate throne in Syria to do the evil things that Al-Qaeda does for a living. If you remember one single thing from this podcast, it is that romance of civil war, whether it's the Spanish-American War, or one can even go back to the 30 Years' War, many centuries back in Europe, and just how bloody and awful and murderous that conflict was, brother against brother and sister against sister, to see just how awful it is in all of its macabre glory. And while we can have all the moral outrage we want now, and philosophically and historically think that, well, if we look at all the evidence from the past, can't we simply find a way to avoid civil war? But as with all things, there is a certain inevitability to conflict and war and bloodshed and internecine conflict and military versus civilian paramilitaries and such. I mean, the history is just absolutely rife with these things occurring on a habitual basis. I just pointed out that Dr. David Betts, and I would urge you to listen to that interview. It's quite informative. Tells us of what's happening in the UK. I've mentioned some of the guerrilla instances that have taken place simply in the last century after World War II in Europe proper, whether it is the Basque ETA between the Spanish and the French and their separatist movement, or the Bader-Meinhof gang and the Red Terror organizations that found themselves rampaging throughout Europe at that time. We find in Brian Burroughs' book, Days of Rage, he talks about explosives and bombs in American cities being old hat and routine between 1970 and 1973, where it simply became something that you saw all the time, that kind of violence. In Betts' characterization, what his claim is, and I tend to agree with this, is he says that when you have post-nationalist elites more concerned, and in this case those elites would be what appears to be the duly elected federal offices in the UK, as in Prime Minister and all the offices that are filled there. And of course, we find this by extension in Brussels, in the EU, which I like to characterize as the EU-SSR, because when those oppressively overregulated states within the European Union find it insufficient to be governed by what I just described in their own countries, then, of course, they beg, borrow, and steal to have yet another government, a central government in Brussels in this case, over all the large, intrusive, and overweening governments in their respective countries to double down on the bureaucratic nonsense that everybody has to suffer in these countries. My wife and I had the pleasure of visiting Croatia last year, and I recommend, if you're looking for a European vacation, it's an absolutely fantastic and beautiful place to go. And of course, this is anecdotal, and this is within my own bias filter. I found again and again when I spoke to people, they were disgusted with the behavior of the EU, they were disgusted with the behavior of NATO, and they were disgusted with the loss of sovereignty in guiding and helming their own ship of state to go where they wanted to go, regardless of what the central government in Brussels wished for Croatia to be. This is the makings and the root cellar of civil conflict. And it's coming, and it's going to be coming with a vengeance, because Betts makes a number of very interesting conjectures. While he says that the post-national elites don't have a nationalist bone in their body to, from left or right, protect the countries over which they have been appointed or elected to rule, they are more concerned with global agenda items like wokeness, climate agenda, world peace, world famine, all of these kind of things. I always find it ironic when these very large and complicated bureaucratic organizations like the EU allegedly seek peace but tend to be the most warmongering entities in the history of that country since, well, in that group of countries since the end of World War II. Betts, in the case of the United Kingdom, says that there is a certain inevitability to conflict coming to the fore and coming off the slow burn into the fast brew, into the surface connections that would reach into war, that would animate war in England proper. Now, this could be a result of demography. It could be a result of the illegal immigration and the legal immigration pressures that are on nativist Englanders who think that they should have the priority, whether one agrees with this or not. I happen to agree with it. They happen to be there first, much like my Afrikaner-American bones tell me that, well, once the Boers, the Dutch in this case, arrived in the 17th century on the Cape at the very southern tip of Africa, there was no one there to be found, and they turned it into, eventually, a first world country with some very curious political conventions that led to what is arguably some immoral things like apartheid, but nonetheless created a first world country that in 1977 even apparently detonated a nuclear weapon over the Atlantic in a test. An African nation did this. But then again, there it is. When one looks at the history, because demographics are destiny, one would be hard-pressed, for instance, to find a majority white population country that is a third world country. And by extension, 47 of 50, I may have the number off by ones or twos, Islamic majority countries on earth just so happen to be authoritarian hellholes. Betts claim he uses numbers ranging from 4 to 18%, and I think the provenance and calculating powers of the numbers that he employs in the podcast leave me unconvinced that quantifying these kind of things has nothing whatsoever to do for what's going to happen in the offing of whether a civil war occurs or not. There is no one who could have predicted that when Gavril Princip, the Yugoslavian anarchist, as he was characterized at the time in 1914, accidentally happened upon the Archduke Ferdinand and his wife because their driver got lost when they were driving around. He thought that his mission of killing Archduke Ferdinand and his wife was botched, but they just so happened to see each other by accident on a corner. He takes the life of both of them, and the cavalcade of calamities that turns into World War I as a result of entangling alliances and very ill-advised treaties between a number of countries leads to that calamity. By the way, I have to share with you as a quick sidebar, well, how could we have stopped World War II? I think it was C.J. Kilmer, at the wonderful Dangerous History podcast, which if you are not listening to that, you are lesser for it. I find him probably to be one of the premier small L libertarian historians on the internet, if not in contemporary history. He is a fellow Floridian, but he deserves your listenership. If you get a chance, give him a try, see what you think. A time cop goes back, and he's sent by his captain to assassinate Adolf Hitler to stop World War II from happening. He comes back, and he reports to the captain of his section, and he says, "I wasn't able to murder Adolf Hitler, but I was able to assassinate Woodrow Wilson," to which the section leader responds, "Adolf who?" Yes, yes. And the reason for that, of course, is because great men, great events, which one is which, chicken or egg, when it comes to historiography, you pick. Because in the end, it doesn't matter because history is cause and effects. And in this case, what we find is that again and again, quantification of historical events, especially if we try to ex post facto determine, well, if the following numbers had been aligned and these things had happened, it's all about the quality of the event. When I say quality of the event, I mean it has nothing to do with the numbers, and it says it has everything to do with the atomistic human behaviors of dedicated individuals who, whether deliberately or not so deliberately, run into one another and do things that cause friction to increase to such an extent that the friction on the status sticks ignites and turns into a war conflagration. Hence, we have World War I and what Neil Ferguson, the sometime accurate historian, tells us is the War of the World from 1914 to 1945, with after 1918, that interregnum between then and World War II. Many argue World War II started in September 1939 when the Germans met the Russians in the middle of Poland. One can say that World War II may very well have started not only in the trenches of World War I and not only with the Versailles Treaty and the besting of the Central Powers morphing themselves into the Axis powers, but in the Pacific theater of operations. I think that in 1932, with the consolidation of Japanese invasions in Korea and China, and then the extension of those lodgments, also played a huge role in the creation of World War II later on. Because let's remember, even though the Japanese and the Germans found an alliance of convenience in the Axis, there was not only a non-aggression treaty between the Germans and the Russians until Hitler's launch of Barbarossa in the summer of 1941, which I've discussed in previous episodes, but there was also a non-aggression pact between the Japanese and the Russians that was maintained until those fateful August days in 1945, with the launch of the nuclear weapons in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, that less than 48 hours later, the Japanese forces in Manchuria would find themselves facing an enormous Russian force that would annihilate them in August of 1945 in a direct violation of that friendship treaty. So the point that I'm making here is that Dr. David Betts, respectfully, I just don't think that there is a quantification means that doesn't have a quality or historiographical accompaniment that makes any sense in forecasting or predicting civil war. Now, what is my opinion of Betts' bet, that's amusing, that civil war is in the offing in England, in the United Kingdom? I think it is a fair bet. I think it may very well happen. I think, as a matter of fact, if something like that doesn't happen within two generations, with the present trajectory of the tolerance of Sharia courts and the Islamist invasion, as it were, of the country, that inevitably they will either find themselves in a civil war through politics, or they will find it thrust upon them when the Islamists succeed in starting a kinetic civil war in order to seize said political infrastructure, or maybe put paid to whatever advances that they've made in that. I'm also going to put in the show notes a great interview that I saw with Winston Marshall. Winston Marshall, like Andrew Gold, is, again, one of my favorite podcasters, and he recently had a gentleman on by the name of Raymond Ibrahim, who just so happens to speak Arabic. He happens to be a Christian, and he's an historian, and it's called The Untold History of the White Slave Trade and How Islam Conquered 3/4 of the Western of the Christian World. And what's really revealing in this interview, and he brings the hand receipts, the footnotes, and all the evidence as to why not only has Islam always been a militant religion that has used invasive war and civil war as a means to advance its religious influence, but that the West, as culpable and I would say at times just silly in bending the knee to a religion to which they don't subscribe. But I suspect that because of the instant and inevitable violence that accompanies criticism or the control thereof, they've kicked the can down the road, especially in the European Union and such, and I think that they have put themselves in a very, very difficult and awkward situation. France probably has the highest Islamist population in the EU and on the European continent at, I think, is 21 or 22%, in which there are ghettos of Islamist conclaves and population concentrations that are no-go zones for the French police and military, which means, by extension, the French polity. The same thing is occurring here. If you take a look at what happened in the UK, for instance, when it came to the grooming gangs and Rotherham and the political players in both Labour and the Tories who tried to play down what turned out to be a single-digit percentage of a Pakistani Muslim demographic that preyed upon young girls in an absolutely savage fashion that I certainly don't want to repeat here on this program. Maybe I'll tackle that sometime in the future, but the details are just so grisly and will make you so angry you will wonder how they haven't kicked every one of them out of the country. But nonetheless, it's just astonishing how they have convinced themselves that Islamic concentrations in their country aren't a clear and present danger, not only to their sovereignty, not only to their safety, but to their internal peace as a civil society. So I've talked about the European countries in the West, and I've looked at their civil wars, especially in what I consider to be a powder keg in the European Union, because I think that the UK is not going to kick off in a civil war before Ireland does. This Ireland not being Northern Ireland, but the island of Ayr, which is the southern Irish counties, E-I-R-E, because the political class there across all of their parties has not only been woke, but has opened up the floodgate for both legal and illegal immigration in a country that has approximately 6 million people in it. And I am starting to see a lot of the indicators and warnings of friction points as far as the burning and sabotaging of things that are going on in Ireland proper. Again, Dr. Betts brings up a very interesting point where he talks about ULEZ, which is the London means of taxing people who are driving around in London proper. ULEZ is the ultra-low emission zone in an area in London, England. Well, according to, and it appears that the Mayor Khan is the one who introduced this thing, and what it does is it really puts these disproportionate tolls on people operating private motor vehicles in London. To me, it looks like a payola scheme just to draw revenue from hapless taxpayers. And in this case, they estimate between 1,500 and 2,000 of these ULEZ cameras have been vandalized and destroyed by various actors who will, for instance, ride up on a motorcycle with the plates removed and helmets on, and they will saw through them, vandalize them, destroy them. And what's interesting is that I think there's only been one person charged in all of these incidents with that vandalism. And the vandalism, much like Irish democracy, which is a concept where, well, we'll just not pay attention to what's going on, or we simply won't obey. In this case, how many people in London do you think see these ULEZ guys going in there with a bandsaw or whatever tool that they're using to cut down the pillar or cause damage to the ULEZ cameras and such? They don't call it in. They don't report it. They don't stop them because they all uniformly hate it. It's a great indicator and warning on what's going on over there. So my forecast, I don't do predictions here, and forecasts could turn out not to be correct, as are all weather reports here in Florida, is what I find inevitably is that, yes, Ireland is the canary in the coal mine. The UK could be the next to find itself embroiled in civil war. But history is full of surprises, as I told you with the Russian proverb that I mentioned earlier in this podcast. Some kind of black swan event could occur where the wrong woman is raped and murdered in Sweden, and all of a sudden, that being the home of all grenade attacks in the EU, that starts a civil war. It could happen practically anywhere in the European Union as we speak. I consider it a tinderbox. But let's do this. Most of my audience is American. And if you don't happen to be American and you listen to my podcast, I want to thank you for your listenership and tolerating my very American-centric, not only language, but historical views and such. But I do try to pay attention to what's happening in the Western world. I do pay attention to the Eastern world less so because I simply don't speak any of those languages. But let's get closer to home. I'm an American. I happen to live in Florida. What is my forecast or prognosis, not prediction, for civil war in America? Do I think that there is a certain inevitability to it? I do. I just so happen to have, over the weekend, seen one in person and several virtually and through correspondence with friends, colleagues, and acquaintances, this No Kings protest that's been going on. For those who aren't Americans and want to appreciate, what is this divide, this political construct that is bifurcating Americans between Republicans and Democrats, conservatives and liberals? While I do think that there are differences between the two, I am a uniparty acolyte who thinks that the Republicans and the Democrats happen to be the two left wings of the predatory bird of government, and that when it comes to liberals and conservatives, they both find themselves aligned with a lot of the welfare and warfare policies that are rife from the local to the county to the state to the federal level in these modern United States. I have always considered the bifurcation to be between rural and urban. That is probably the sharpest contrast. Rural folk pride themselves on their self-sufficiency, and urban folk pride themselves on their lack of self-sufficiency, and ex-urb and suburban folks consider themselves a combination of the two, depending on the state that they happen to be in. So I wouldn't say that Republican or Democrat affiliation would necessarily be a marker for civil war, and it certainly isn't going to have the clean geographical lines one found with the Second American Civil War from 1860 to 1865, in which there were such clear demarcation lines, although an argument would be had by those who were in Kentucky, Tennessee, and Missouri at the time as to who was who and whose allegiance was who. But nonetheless, Is civil war possible in America? I think America has been in a cold civil war for a very long time because there is a bifurcation between those who want less government and those who want maximum government. I do think that those are the embers and flashpoints at which a kinetic civil war could start here. Those in narrow interest bands, I happen to be pro-life, but between pro-life and pro-infanticide folks, there is a very sharp demarcation there. And there is a history from both sides of using violence to prove their point in this country. The same thing applies when it comes to what we've seen with the immigration riots and the illegal immigration seizures, detentions, and expropriations that have occurred since the new administration came in office in January. It has caused, again, breathing oxygen into embers that have always been there. These demarcations of tolerance of government interference in one's private life, your public life in this case, being the conduct of business, whether you own your own business, you happen to be a corporate drone or whatever the case may be. And again, that would be that bifurcation. I cannot measure what is going to be the kinetic flashpoint, much like the very clear kinetic flashpoints of Lexington and Concord, April 19th, 1775, or what occurred at Fort Sumter between the North and the South. All of those things, on reflection, one can look back at decades before each of those events in all the parts and pieces and components of both the Black Swan events and the inevitable events that led to kinetic civil war are certainly there. So I don't have a prediction. I have a forecast. The weather is going to be stormy, and the possibility, not the probability, but the possibility of civil war in America is certainly there. The probability, I put it years out, but there are a number of, well, again, black swan events, things that none of us could predict or forecast that would lead instantly to kinetic civil war. One of those could be a coronal mass ejection or an electromagnetic pulse event over both coasts or one coast that renders all electronic capabilities and notions of modern industrial first world civilization rendered moot. Of course, if we listen to William Fortune in his books where he talks about this very kind of thing. As a matter of fact, it was William Fortune's novels that inspired the Congress at the beginning of the 2000s to even take electromagnetic pulse, EMP, seriously, whether man-made or solar-made. He projected a 90% die-off in the first year, and I thought at first, well, that's absolutely outlandish. How could that be? But then when you do the numbers, when you think it through, when you examine the evidence, if our electronic infrastructure, our electric infrastructure, all of a sudden goes awry as a result of the CME, or in my mind, goes awry by getting rid of fossil fuels and nuclear power and only adopting allegedly renewable resources like solar and wind, I think that that would render our civilization moot also. But look at the number of people who are on medicines. Look at the requirements of refrigeration. I live in Florida. Look at the requirements of air conditioning. Look at all these wonderful things we have living in this absolutely wondrous time of humanity in this, for us in the United States and the West, Yugoslavia accepted, my apologies to you, but this relatively peaceful means by which we have had all of these wonderful civilizational attributes and things where the poorest people in America are living as the finest kings and queens and royal houses in the 19th century in Western Europe and around the world, lived, they would be in awe and wonder at what the most impoverished people in our respective civilizations have as a matter of convenience, leisure time, and the ability to feed their faces and take care of their children. I think that those niche and boutique causes are not going to put us on the road to civil war. And if you look at this historically, rarely will you find civil wars emerging from comfortable Western societies in which, while there may be measurable political turmoil and disagreements among the populace, it usually doesn't go to sword or gun and brother against brother, unless something rather calamitous happens, as I just described what would happen if a CME or a man-made EMP laid us low, or maybe there was an attack in America proper, as I talked about in my Storming America podcast, and as I also talked about, if we had the temerity and stupidity to take American government assets and decapitate or go after the Mexican and, by extension, international drug cartels and human trafficking cartels. I think in order for a civil war to occur in America, it's not going to occur as long as the economy is still in one piece. As a trained Austrian economist, I am in awe and I am just baffled by the fact that with a total debt of $37 trillion, which, by the way, has been erected in a mere three decades in America, that I don't know how this magic box of an economy sustains itself. There are plenty of opinions out there from left and right, Marxian to Austrian, to tell us why it occurs the way it does. It is not within the scope of this podcast to let you know in detail what that is. If I had a listener write in to cgpodcast@pm.me, look at that, I'm doing it early, cgpodcast@pm.me, which you can also find in the show notes. Happy to talk Austrian economics, but certainly not within the scope of this podcast. So do I think civil war is inevitable? As with all things, I must attach precursors to this. I must tell you, well, if the following happens, yes. If these other things happen, no. So one thing that I can say out loud is that if the economy remains relatively strong, whatever your opinion of that may be, employment remains high, the fiat currency remains aloft, and people don't find themselves wanting for food, air conditioning, vehicles, gasoline, things like that, I don't see it happening. But all bets are off if one of two things happens, or a combination thereof. Number one, we do suffer some kind of catastrophic event that renders what makes Western civilization so low cost and convenient today a moot point, or an invasion facilitated through the massive illegal immigration, not only of the past administration, but the immigration policies in America since the 1960s. And if that happens in combination with other kinetic events, then I think that all of the chess pieces on the board will be in the hazard. And as Henry V said, if the Dauphin in France seeks to set my crown in the hazard, then of course things will occur as a result of that. Yes, Shakespeare's Henry V is my very favorite play of all time. I used to have I still have it in a shadow box that my wife so lovingly made for me with some of my accoutrements from my military career of my small leather-bound copy of Henry V that I would bring to the field with me so that I can read it during high tea in the afternoon. So I guess my very easy answer is, hey, peace happens until it doesn't. So I hope to get back to my rock-solid and ritualistic fortnightly issuance of the podcast, whether that be Chasing Ghost or War Notes. I wanted to thank all my listeners for your solicitude. I wanted to especially thank my paid subscribers and You're making it possible for me to make advances in this, get the research material I need to keep these at the highest quality I can deliver to you, even the electronic means that I have to use. As a matter of fact, recently I retained the services of one organization that electronically improves the podcast episodes themselves. I'm still trying to massage out whatever those wrinkles may be, but I have had complaints, and rightly so in the past, that some of the sound quality on these podcast episodes isn't up to the professional standard that I wish them to be, but I intend to invest some money into fixing that. So I will let you know, and I'll start with the first 10 episodes, but for new listeners, I'm hoping, oh, look, he sounded so professional. It's amazing. For my older listeners who suffered some of the quality downfalls and downsides of a previous recording, I'm hoping to fix that ex post facto. So if you wish to get in touch with me, you can get in touch with me at cgpodcast@pm.me. That is cgpodcast@pm.me. If you use Substack, which I urge you to use, you will find my podcast has a home there, both the War Notes and Chasing Ghost podcast. And that is also in the show notes, how you can get there. And that has a comment function. Look, I love paid subscribers. I don't have a lot of them. My hat's off. I salute you for parting with your hard-earned money to subsidize my efforts here, and thanks a lot. So if you get a chance, I have one ask. I'd love you to be a paid subscriber, but if you don't want to, I get it. These are tough times for most. But if you have friends, family, acquaintances, or professional colleagues who you think may be interested in hearing the things that I have to say, spread the word. I'd be obliged. If you can leave reviews, whether that be a star review or a narrative review, again, I'd be obliged. You can reach me at cgpodcast@pm.me. That is cgpodcast@pm.me. And again, thanks everybody for your listenership, especially if you got this far. This is Bill, out.